session number 18463, Reel 2.
Dunbar, it's Reel 2. So, if it was unnecessary for those in charge of the basic training to behave in an unreasonable way, why did they do it?
I really could not tell you that at all. I mean, the training battalion, when you went to your own battalion, things were so different, entirely different. Different attitude, understanding, and everything seemed to me to be such a change that I really couldn't believe it, you know, when we went eventually got to Hong Kong. But at the end of our training, we had the usual passing out parades. In fact, the passing out parade on the ORM-1 parade, which we had before we went on a continuation, there was I suppose it must have been area commander's inspection the day before, and we've been bullying these boots up for, you know, 8 weeks all over. We didn't just do the toes, a whole lot had to be balled up. We had this inspection and dashed about the square and things like that, and of course it all cracked. So for our passing out parade, it went off well, but we had this nervous fact that our boots had all cracked.
Where was this passing out parade?
That was at Shorncliffe.
And where did you go to after Shorncliffe?
Well, Shorncliffe, we went to the... we then finished our R1 and went on to continuation, and then went to the holding company, which was also at number 2 holding company, which was over in the Napier Barracks place, where we drew straight away, there was no question of people going to their battalions. So the Buffs and the Royal West Kents and the rest of them were all rebadged to Middlesex. I suppose I was lucky. I was Middlesex, and the draft was Middlesex. So we drew our jungle green kit and went off on embarkation leave. I guess that was 10 days or a fortnight, whatever it was. Then when we came back, drew our kit out again. And they promoted three draft lance corporals and one corporal. And that was done, they did tell us, that was done by who had the smartest bed layout. So with one exception, the three lance corporals were promoted on who had the smartest bed layout. And the corporal was an old soldier who had never had a stripe in his life. And they were the draft NCOs. But the draft, when we marched down to Sheraton, was commanded by a Colour Sergeant O'Keefe, who was I would only describe him as a lean and hungry man. He was on his last year of service in the army. In fact, he went off to Malaya and joined the Malayan police and laid an ambush, and having told everybody, anybody coming down there, you shoot, did just that and got himself shot. So poor old O'Keefe got himself killed in Malaya about 1951, I guess, two, something like that. But anyway, we then went off to march down to Sheraton, train up to, we passed through Waterloo Junction, which is rather funny really, up to Charing Cross, where there were coaches waiting for us. They took us back down to Waterloo, where we just passed through, and then we went off to the south coast. And I cannot, for the life of me, remember the port, because we used to go to Guernsey, and we used to go from Weymouth, and I sometimes think we went from Weymouth. We certainly didn't go from Southampton, so it was either Portsmouth, Plymouth, or Weymouth. But I have a feeling it was Weymouth, because it was a large port, and the Cunard Queens went out of there. And we were on HMT Empire Orwell, which was a ex-German cruise liner that had been sunk, and presumably in harbour, because they got it up and apparently put an extra deck in and turned it into a troop ship. And she was we sailed out behind one or other of the Queens, probably the Queen Mary in those days, I expect. Band on the shore playing, and the dockers waving.
What was the voyage like?
We got to the Biscay, of course, which is a fairly notable place for bad seas. And the seas were dreadful, absolutely dreadful. But the Orwell was a new type of troop ship. It wasn't her first voyage, but it was the new type with bunks instead of hammocks and cafeteria-type meals. And when you got on board, you obviously all went down and the kit bags were stowed around the edge and the captain didn't inspect anything and we went off. And everybody was given a duty. And I had the best duty that there could possibly be. In the morning, we had to parade at the dry canteen. They'd take us down into the hold and then we'd bring up crates of oranges and drinks and chocolate and stuff like that. Give it to the canteen manager. He would give us first choice of whatever we wanted. That was us for the rest of the day. But of course, most of the poor lads had cookhouse duties and dining room duties. And when we got into Biscay, and the seas were absolutely dreadful, because they had a terrible time. They were all being sick. The bunks all had a little galvanised container on the side for you to be sick in, and then you were supposed to take this when it became full over to a galvanized dustbin which you poured it in, and then every day I don't know where they were emptied. Some poor soul had the job of taking these up on deck and emptying them somewhere or other. And I must admit, I got through it all very, very well, but I was just going up the stairs and I happened to look into this galvanized dustbin. Just too much for me. I wasn't sick, but there was it was very near. But by staying on deck, see, not having duties, I could stay on deck and the fresh air was burning. I mean, the worst ones were the naval draft. There was a draft, National Service, of course, National Service sailors going out to Hong Kong, and those poor lads, they were up on the deck, heaving, far worse than most of the squad is, you know. But we got through the bay, saw Jib. Well, first of all, we saw the lights of Lisbon on the high left port, isn't it? On the port side. Then we saw Jib. We passed through Jib. And I was amazed because Jib, I'm sure you know, is covered in a great big concrete slab to collect the water down into the reservoir. And I just didn't know what that was, you know. On the other side was Spanish Morocco, as it was then. We sailed off down through the Med. We saw Pantelleria, the island, actually saw Pantelleria and the lights of Malta, and eventually came to Port Said. We sort of sailed along the coast. It's a bit like if you go to Boulogne, how you sail along the sand dunes and things for a long way from sort of Calais to Boulogne, don't you? And it was a bit, little bit like that, whether it was on our starboard side. And as you got nearer to Port Said, you began to smell it, because Port Said is the smelliest port anywhere. They get fresher as you go farther east. Port Said is the most dreadful smelling place. And they allowed us off there. We were still in battle dress, incidentally, you know, khaki battle dress. And we had a photograph taken and a meal and, you know, things like that. And I remember the first sight, the shops, I couldn't believe it. They were stocked full of British goods, things that we couldn't get. Those great tins of Rose's chocolates and all the boxes of chocolates, all the Cadbury's. I couldn't believe it. You know, it was all rationed back here. And all the stuff was going out there for export. And it was unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable. De Lesseps' statue was still there then, of course. It's been blown up now. We had a little chat with a policeman. You know, the old red fest blue uniform and an ancient rifle, who claimed that he'd been a sniper in the Egyptian army and killed many Israelis in some engagement or other. Then we went one off down the canal. But we must have sailed at night, because we woke up in the morning and it was as if the ship was sailing through the desert. You know, the desert on the left side was just sand, and on the right there's a lake. It's got a name like Mazala or Mazila or some name like that. It's and it, with the sun on it, it looks like a mirage, and you can see upside down ships and, you know, presumably towns and things like that as they shimmer off this thing. It looked more like a sort of salt-lake, for want of a better word. I think it was pretty vast. And then the ships go down the canal. On the right-hand side is the Sweetwater Canal. That's the canal they built, to build the canal. It was the survey barges. But it was so dreadful then that they told us that if anybody drops in it, they have to take them straight to hospital because it was just a cesspit, you know. Go down to pass all these various stations, and they were all little red brick places with whitewash everywhere, like a lock, a little bit like a lock on the Thames, red brick, all with the Union Jack up, and they were about every 10 miles, I'd guess. I mean, I've no idea, but I mean, I guess they were about 10 miles apart until you came down to one of the lakes. And then the ships pulled stop up for a while, anchor in one of the lakes, and the next lot go back up. And then you go down to the next enormous great lake, and that was quite reasonably full of ships, you know, all anchored, and the next lot goes up. And you go down then to Suez, the port of Suez as it was then. And they didn't allow us off at Suez. Through the Red Sea, and the sand, every morning, the decks are covered in sand blowing in off the Red Sea, down to Aden. Now, Aden's a terrible place, Aden. It's a volcano, built in a volcano. And they didn't allow us off there because I think there's always trouble there, you know. I suppose they thought unruly soldiers would cause more trouble. And then we went off then, would have been the Indian Ocean, wouldn't it? Across to Colombo, as it was then, and Ceylon, where we were allowed ashore. And that was quite... But this time we changed... On the way through the Suez, we changed into JJ, into Jungle Green. In fact, coming down the Suez, there were two great pillars, concrete pillars, not unlike Vimy Ridge, funny enough. And they're a memorial to the defence of the canal during the Great War. And there were a couple of... RAF blokes on there saying, get your knees brown, you know, the old going east thing, get your knees brown. Their little white knees all showing there. Because Port Said, because there's the bum boats in Port Said, and they all round the boat, you know. But we were going out, so there wasn't, we weren't very keen on buying rugs and things like that. And they were doing their performance there. They have a little basket and they throw a rope up and you haul up the basket, put your money in, drop it back down again, and they hopefully put the goods in and send it back up. But of course, some of the lads were tossing lighted cigarettes into their rugs, and one of them suddenly started hurling abuse up at us. He held his rug up with his great big burnt hole in it, much to the amusement of all the Scotties. And they all got a little bit upset then, and there was a, I don't know where the hell they got them from, but they got big china mugs from the mess hall, and they were throwing these china mugs down onto the boats below, and they were getting a bit upset. And in the end, we were all dispersed, you know, the troop police, you know, RPs dispersed everybody, sent us below. And then the crew got a fire hose and played it on the boats there and got rid of them all, you know. And we were confined below decks then for a little while, you know. They weren't too pleased with that. Colombo, where we got off at Colombo, we came in there very early in the morning. It was so hot, dreadfully hot. And a little flat-bottomed boat, we drew our money, incidentally, before you drew your money at both all these ports, you drew your money and then went ashore with whatever the currency was at the time. And a little flat-bottomed boat took, not a little flat-bottomed boat, a rather large flat-bottomed boat took us up to the quay, and then we went ashore. We got talking to some traders, not buying from them, but talking to them. And I was quite surprised because they said, first of all, they said they remembered the Orwell from pre-war as a German cruise liner. And they said they thought there was something about her that was different. Her superstructure was a bit different. She was sleeker in those days, which was apparently true. They built another sort of deck on her or something like that. and they were saying how upset they were that the colonial rule had finished. And I'll be honest, at the time we thought, I don't know, they're trying to have us on. But I don't think they were, because business, it's all to do with business. Their business had gone. The cruise liners weren't coming anymore. The government wasn't, whatever the government of the day wasn't looking after them and things like that. I think they were genuinely, at that time, upset that their business had gone downhill. They didn't really care about colonial rule. It was the business side of it, you know. We went to the far side of the island and were shown the coast of India. I think it was islands, to be quite honest, but they said it was the coast of India. And then we sailed off to towards Singapore. Passed on the way. I'm not entirely sure who it was. I believe it was a King of Siam's yacht, big, great big steam yacht, you know, and it had lights everywhere, all round the decks, up the mast and everywhere. And they used to give this information over the tannoy system, and they said it was the King of Siam's steam yacht, but it would be Thailand now, wouldn't it? But I might be wrong about that. It was a king of somewhere other. Then we went down through, I don't think it's called the Malaya Strait. I think it was called the Malacca Strait then, but it's a lot wider than the channel. But it's a very busy seaway, you know, for modern ships and native ships and what have you. And then into Singapore. But when we got to Singapore, we all had to go below decks and lay on our bunks whilst they docked, you know. And we were only allowed off there for about 4 hours, I think. The crew went off first, and that were going ashore, you know, mainly stewards and stuff like that. And we went off for about 4 hours, and the dockside was all the railings and that had holes in them, you know, from the bombing, our bombing and the Japanese bombing and what have you. We went down the road, and I couldn't believe it. There it said Bushy Park. Well, I live next to Bushy Park, you know, Hampton Court. There was Bushy Park, but not much bigger than our garden sort of thing, you know. And we went on a bit farther, and we'd be warned that meals might be a bit tricky and you'd be a bit unwise to, buy fruit and stuff like that, because it was all under human excrement, you know. Went on, and there was another gang, but this time coming back, and they said to go down the road there and look in this window. Wouldn't tell us what it was, so about 300 yards down the road, went down there. Dreadful sight I've ever seen. It was a clinic for elephantitis, which is apparently a common disease in the East. And there were these colour photographs of these enormous testicles. I mean, you'll think I'm exaggerating, but I mean, as big as a football. They were bigger than a football. Dreadful sights. So we went back on the ship then. We'd had enough of Singapore. And she must have sailed, I think she must have sailed either late that night or early the next morning, because the sun was low, and the virgin jungle on the Malaya side, beautiful. It really looked lush and beautiful. And there were many, many islands, all of them sticking up out the sea with jungle, for want of a better word, on them, you know. Quite remarkable. And we went off then, about a day's sail out from there, was the most dreadful storm came up again. Far worse than the Bay of Biscay. We were sailing into the seas, and if you visualise, the seas are enormous, enormous seas. And because I presume this, I'm guessing this now, I didn't realise this when I looked out when we got up. I presume the ship is going down one and coming up through the other. But the impression you get is that the waves, they were higher than the mast. I never see a frightening thing it was. And of course the cookhouses all thought, hello, that'll be in there. Having their sick again, weren't they? But of course we weren't. And the first sitting, they all had sittings, had coloured things to show up, you know. And of course everybody was there for breakfast, and there wasn't enough breakfast to go around. But there was a lot, and a number of them. I mean, my friend of mine, he'd be sick the moment we got out to sea, sort of thing, you know, and he was all sick. But generally speaking, people have got their sea legs by now, you know, and they had to start setting the poor old cooks at it, cooking more food for breakfast. There's one amusing thing there. Well, I don't know amusing, but one of the chaps, Gunner, he was, I imagine he was a regular, I don't know, but he had not a single hair on his head. He was absolutely, utterly bald. And he was allowed to wear his beret at all times. So at meal times, he always wore his beret. And, of course, that's a crime in any army, isn't it, wearing your beret in the inside. And all you could see was that he had not a single hair, presumably nothing on the top as well. It was a pity, really, because in many respects, if he'd have taken his beret off, you'd have looked at it a couple of times and forgotten all about it. But because he always wore his beret, you couldn't help thinking, you know, not a crime. And we got through these seas, without any problems at all. We were sleeping on deck, by the way, by this time. And I'd made a serious mistake, as had many others. There was no sun, and I had my shirt off all day. And we were warned, no excuse whatsoever, we were warned that the sun was always there, whether it was cloudy or not, and that getting sunburned was a crime, you know, self-inflicted wound. And I got really sunburned. Started to peel, and I naturally had my shirt on now, trying to hide it, because I didn't want to go sick and, you know, get in a little spot of bother. And I was dreading, when we got to Hong Kong, it was FSMO again, you know, Field Service Marching Order again, with a blanket wrapped around your pack. And I knew what that would do to me when we got to Hong Kong, and it did. Stripped me back of skin, you know, absolutely stripped it of skin. So for the first, and Hong Kong, part of the mode of dress in Hong Kong was no shirts. Even for, orderly corporals, for example, you'd get up in the morning if you're orderly corporal, and you'd have boots, putties, hose tops, shorts, belt and bayonet, no shirt, and what we called a brown beret. I think it's because we couldn't spell khaki, probably, but it was a khaki beret, but it was always known in training as brown beret. I'm sure that's because we couldn't spell khaki, but... And brown beret, and of course everybody with sunburn sort of skin. Well, that was we arrived in Hong Kong. I think we must have arrived in the morning. We weren't allowed off the ship until the evening. It was dark when we got off, and I'm only guessing this, but I guess they let you off in regimental groups, because there would have been the various regiments, the Leicesters, the Argylls, and the Cosby, and KSLI, because when we got off, we went down the gangplank, and there were 3-ton lorries waiting for us. It was pitch black by this time, and raining actually, and we were taken up to B Stables Camp, which is up near Fan Ling. That was the old jockey club, and so we lived in the stables, and the stables were a roof and just low walls with bunks, two-tier bunks, and biscuits. They weren't mattresses, they were biscuits. 3 biscuits filled with coconut fibre. And that terrible stuff that is, because it's not soft, and it just goes into lumps, so it's really like laying on a mattress cover with lumps sort of thing, you know. And we had our kit bags up on, there was a dividing wall down the centre, so you stuck your kit bags up on there, 2 bunks, and you had a kit box. And as I say, it was all open, so that when the and of course mosquito nets, of course, and when the rains came, I mean, they don't come down like that, they come laterally along, you know, most people call them monsoons, but for some reason right in the middle, so they call them the rains. I suppose it's a bit superior, you know. It's not a bit, it's too bad. And they literally came along like that, and sort of, you had to lay in bed with your poncho over you, you know, to keep the wet off. But because when you've been there a few weeks, everybody had skin diseases of various types, and prickly heat was about the worst, ringworm and prickly heat. And the moment it rained, you'd see people stripping off and racing out, and it's wonderful on the skin, you know, really cooling on the skin. And then they paint you with different colours. There's a sort of a mauve colour and a green colour, and I think there was a yellow colour, but I'm not quite sure about that, for various sort of places, you know. And, but within, I suppose, a month, everybody was down with skin diseases. And that was like ringworm, prickly heat. Everybody's got prickly heat, which is most uncomfortable. And for myself, I had ringworm, which is literally a ring of suppurating sort of, you know, things, all mainly around your waist area. Then your feet, between your toes, that cracks, and it, there's a gungy stuff comes out, it's terrible smelling stuff. And that was known as chinky toe rot. By us, I mean, that wasn't what the MO would have called it. And then you get, between your legs, you get suppurating sores. And that will, that'll be as big as your hand eventually. And it'll go all over your genitals and, you know, skinning. And so the inside of your underclothes were bright yellow every day, you know, where this, these things... you had to keep going to the MO and having them painted and things like that. So you had chinky toe rot, these suppurating sores around there, prickly heat, and ringworm. And I was lucky; I didn't get this, but my friend had it all over his face as well, like a bit like impetigo when you were in the school. I really don't know what that is, because all I remember is he had green paint all over his. Face sort of thing, you know, where they used to do them, look after them. Injections are regular, of course, TABs and things like that, you know. I forgot to say, but of course, I was quite a hefty chap, you know, half hefty young fellow in those days. And my first injection at Shorncliffe, I was the only one who fainted. I remember thinking to myself, oh, thank goodness that's over. The next minute, I remember... I'd hit my head on the concrete. I was sitting on the ground with the chap with a towel sort of wiping me down and saying, are you all right? Are you all right? The embarrassment of fainting. I also deafened myself at Shorncliffe. I was given the job, nice cushy little job, field firing, sent off in a log bunker with a skeleton rifle and told to, 100 rounds I had a blank. And keep firing this blank, which was simulate return fire, you know, on the field firing thing. Next day, I'm as deaf as a post. I wouldn't go sick because it meant back squatting all the time, you see, and no one wanted to be back squatted. So I got each day a little bit more, and I watched their mouths to see what they were saying. And after about 3 days, I was reasonably back to normal again. I was okay. So I didn't get back squatting. A lot of them did get back squatting. Some of the OR1s got back squatted although the chap I know didn't, for he couldn't pass the PT course, physical, you know, they sit them on special PT courses. They were supposed to back squat him, but they didn't, in actual fact. He got away with it. But he shouldn't have known. He wasn't fit for the infantry, in actual fact, as was proved in Korea.
But you're saying you were having these injections in Hong Kong?
Oh, yeah, regularly. I mean, they were TABs. I can't remember what they were all for. They were all sorts of things, you know. But you had them on a fairly regular basis. I would think every couple of months you'd have to go down and have an injection, things like that.
What kind of duties did you have in Hong Kong?
Well, we were up the territories, you see. We weren't actually...